Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
Indeed, today is the day. It's the 7th of May. The 7th of May happens to be my wedding anniversary, and today happens to be my 8th wedding anniversary. So although he's not listening yet, he'll listen later. Good morning, my beloved Jim. Happy anniversary. It gives me an opportunity to talk about what marriage is and what marriage is not. Marriage is as God defines it, not as whatever we might imagine it to be. Marriage is actually an eternal reality between Christ and his church. That's what's revealed to us in the scriptures. And that's the reality that we reflect in our marriages here now in this day and time. And so if you're a Christian, marriage is not whatever you imagine it to be. It's not even about our personal fulfillment. It's not about our personal happiness. It is about reflecting the reality of an eternal relationship between Jesus Christ and his church. And that's a real privilege and a real honor in marriage to be participating in something that is bearing active physical witness to other people of an eternal reality. And so maybe like me, you are in what I would describe as a redeemed marriage or a marriage that is seeking to redeem marriage in the eyes of others. Jim has 6 kids. And so when I met Jim and discovered, you know, he's really my person, he came with a lot of other people. And sometimes that happens. And we now have the opportunity to redeem marriage in and with and for all of those kids. And so we're now actively doing that, not only with those kids, but for spouses who have come into the family and 5 grandbabies already, and I'm anticipating, a whole lot more in the years to come. So happy anniversary, Jim. I look forward to walking with you on the road ahead all the way to the Father's house. And maybe you're saying to yourself right now, I don't have anyone with whom I'm walking. And I want to encourage you today if you are single. I was single into my 40s, and I know that road. And if you're walking the road of singleness today, I want to assure you, you do not walk alone. You have a family of fellow believers, companions for the journey. And I want to encourage us and challenge us as the body of Christ in the world today that we need to bear positive witness to what it means to be brothers and sisters in Christ, walking with one another all the way home to the Father's house. And certainly those of us who are married need to take seriously the opportunity and the privilege and the joy that it is to represent to others in this time and in this day an eternal reality, that of marriage. So if you are married, here's a little encouragement and challenge for the day. What might happen today if you simply reached out your hand in gentle affection and took the hand of your spouse and assured them that you are with them and you are for them, no matter what, all the way home to the Father's house? No turning of eyes, no turning of hearts to the right or to the left. You walk together as one toward home. How might that act? How might that verbal assurance change not only today and tomorrow and the road ahead, but other people's perception of eternity? All right, we've got a lot. We got a lot of road to cover here today. So up next, Tommy Binion from the Heritage Foundation. He and I are going to start a deep dive into the number one issue that Americans say concern them. It is health care. That's next here on Mornings with Carmen. All right, joining me now, Tommy Binion from the Heritage Foundation. You can read in on what we're talking about today at dailysignal.com. If you look under their categories and topics, you're going to find healthcare. There's lots of articles and resources posted there. Tommy and I are going to start a deep dive into this conversation. It is the number one issue concerning Americans across the country as they look toward 2020. And so we want to give it our attention as well. You can follow Tommy on Twitter at TP Binion. Tommy, welcome back.
Good morning and happy anniversary. And it's great to be with you talking healthcare this morning.
Well, good morning, and thank you so much. All right, so I'm going to start with this. I went to a thing in downtown Nashville at one point in time, and there were people lining the streets with signs that said healthcare is a human right. Is healthcare a human right? What are our responsibilities for the, you know, like our own care of our own health?
Well, I think that a right comes from God. It's a freedom that human beings have that the government agrees to secure and to protect and to not infringe in any way. If I had to guess, those folks at that protest holding those signs, when they said healthcare is a right, what they meant is that the government needs to pay for it and guarantee it for all people and be in charge of it. And I actually think the truth is something closer to the exact opposite of that. We know that the pursuit of happiness is a right. And I count the pursuit of good, quality, affordable, accessible healthcare under the pursuit of happiness. So in that sense, I think it is a right. But if we go in the policy direction that the left wants us to go, and if we have the government paying for healthcare, we won't actually be able to pursue the best healthcare under the best circumstances for us. Actually, private health insurance will be outlawed, and all of our healthcare decisions will be made by the government. So if that sounds right to you, healthcare is a right, perhaps what you really think is the pursuit of happiness is a right, and that includes my ability to go out and have access to the United States healthcare system, which is the best in the world. And it doesn't mean I want the government to take over administration of healthcare. Those are two different things, and I think, unfortunately, the people who want the government to take over administration of the healthcare, those are the ones often with the signs that say healthcare is a right. So as people who believe it's the free market that delivers the best product, we reject that idea. But I do think that everybody listening to that phrase, healthcare is a right, there's something real about that. And I think it's this pursuit of happiness.
So I know that just this week, right, the House is taking up and voting on a bill that would walk back some of the Trump administration's regulatory relief efforts. 64% of Americans say that what they want in healthcare is to build on what is working and fix what isn't working. This looks like House Democrats trying to break something that is working. And so when we talk about Medicare for all, I want you to tell us, when we hear that language, what is meant by it?
Sure. So Medicare for all, it sounds great, right? We can admit that Medicare is a popular program and that it sounds like a solution to our healthcare problem. But I think the truth is it's a nightmare. And if those 64% of people want to keep what is working in the healthcare system, Medicare for all does the exact opposite. There are 181 Americans today that are on private health insurance. Medicare for all would kick them.
It has to be more than 181. I'm one, and you're probably one. So
181 million. Sorry,
million. Okay. No, it's okay. Million. This is my job, is like to listen carefully and be like, that can't be right. Okay. 181 million. Thank you.
181 million Americans are on private insurance today, and Medicare for all would kick them off of their private insurance. And instead, Medicare for all would replace private insurance with a government-administered health insurance system. So what that would mean is the government decides what you are insured for, what coverage you will get, what they will pay for. The government would act like it does in Medicare, and it would set the price for certain healthcare services. So it would tell doctors what they're allowed to charge. It would actually impose a fine on doctors for entering into private contracts with American citizens. So if you go out and find a doctor who's really good at a surgery, but that's not what the Medicare for All system has prescribed, then that doctor would owe a fine for giving you that surgery. It's a really terrifying future if Medicare for All is it. And I'll just add one other layer. None of that sounds good to me. None of that sounds like it replaces, keeps what is working and replaces what it's broken. But on top of that, it would bankrupt the country. It would cost $32 trillion over 10 years. We're already running $1 trillion deficits on top of $22 trillion debts. And so to impose that kind of cost on the federal government would be devastating. Even if we could pull it off, we would never recover from it.
Okay, so when we come back, let's talk about some language that I think is really confusing to people. Let's talk about what a single-payer system is, like what defines that. If there is one that's out there that's working somewhere in the globe for a country that's as large and diverse as America, let's talk about those issues when we come back. Again, Tommy Bennion and I are doing, we're beginning a deep dive into the healthcare conversation. He is from the Heritage Foundation. You can check out what we're talking about at dailysignal.com. We'll be right back.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the Capitol.
All right, friends, we're back. I am joined by Tommy Bennion from the Heritage Foundation. You can find him at thedailysignal.com. Actually, there's no the, just dailysignal.com. You can also find him on Twitter at TP Bennion. We're talking about healthcare, and we're beginning a deep dive into this conversation. And so, Tommy, what is a single-payer system? Because I might misunderstand that language to suggest, hey, if I want to buy it, I pay for it. I'm the single payer of my own little system. That is not what we're talking about. So talk about what a single payer system is, and then identify if there's one in the globe, around the globe, that is working for a nation as large and diverse as America.
Yeah, so single payer means the government pays the health insurance bills. So doctors remain in private practice, although the only entity paying for their services is the government, which means the government sets the cost. And this is actually what we have for a small population of people in the United States under Medicare. Individuals go to a hospital, go to a doctor, get the healthcare service they want, and then those doctors bill the government. But the government is the government. It's not a private company, and so it decides what it will and won't pay for certain services. And it decides what services are allowed and what services are not allowed. Of course, this is a big fear that we all have, right? That we'll be diagnosed with some kind of sickness, maybe cancer, maybe we'll get in a car wreck, but there'll be a healthcare service that we need that's more expensive than some substandard healthcare service, and that we'll be forced to go with the cheaper option because of a health insurance problem, because of a problem with the government, if the government indeed takes over the administration and payment of health insurance. So that is the big fear, because that's what happens in other single-payer countries around the globe. And I think, the straight answer to your question, is there another country with the same set of circumstances the United States has where single-payer is working? And the answer is no. And working, by the way, is not good enough. In 2019, with all the technological and scientific and health advancements that we have the greatest healthcare system in the world. Our outcomes are tremendous, and that's what we want to focus on. If you look at a single-payer system like they have in Canada, I mean, in Canada, you've got to wait 4, 5, 6 weeks to see a specialty doctor, a specialist, depending on what you have. And so I think that single payer delivers an inefficient system, that what you will get is a slower system where substandard healthcare services are provided because they are cheaper. And if anybody enjoys their experience with the government, if anybody loves going to the DMV or hears great stories about the VA or really thinks that the tax forms are simple to understand and are a joy to fill out, I think that those people would love a single payer system. But I don't happen to be one of those people.
Okay. So let's, when you say that the government would be the single payer, I think it's important to remind people that we are the government. And so we would be the payers. And when you talk about a $32 trillion bill over 10 years, is that what you said? And you divide that among working Americans, because that's the taxpayer crowd. Every single one of us who pays taxes would be paying a lot more taxes in order to create of ourselves the government, the single payer. In order to create this single payer system, we, the people who are the government here in the United States of America, would have to pony up big money over a long period of time in order to fund such a thing. Otherwise, we just continue to burden emerging generations with a greater and greater debt load that they will never be able to pay.
Right. And I think the debt option is actually not really an option. At some point, you run up your credit card bill so high, they stop issuing you credit cards, right? At some point, your debt gets so big that there isn't a viable path for you to pay it off. And so you're not allowed to take out more debt. And so I think absolutely, if Medicare for All were to be enacted, taxes would necessarily skyrocket. It's taxes on you and me, but Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they say that they're going to get this money by taxing the rich. And that's we know what that means, right? That means taxing American businesses. That means taxing American job creators. That means sucking money out of the economy that's going to do a tremendous amount of good and keep millions of Americans employed. And instead, it's going into the hands of the government. But what really troubles me is for all of this cost, you know, healthcare, as you said at the beginning of the show, is so important. So for all of this cost, what do we get? We get a healthcare system that's worse than the one that we have now. We get a healthcare system where your prognosis, where your outcome is likely worse than it would have been under the healthcare system we have now. So we pay all this money and our outcomes get worse. So I'm with the 64% of Americans that say, I want to keep what is working. I want those 181 million Americans that are on private health insurance to keep it. And then those that don't get health insurance from their employer, or those that are stuck in a coverage gap, or those that it is unaffordable for, we're going to come in and we're going to fix what's broken. We're not going to replace the whole system with something that we know for a fact won't work and it will bankrupt us. So I'm tremendously worried about this. It's gaining steam. The last thing I want to say about Medicare for All is that Bernie Sanders is a champion for it, but four or five or six of the Democratic contenders for the presidential nomination have also signed on to it because of the popularity. So this is not an intangible threat. This is real. This is here today. We need to pay attention to it.
Okay. And let's just remind people, you used the example of a credit card and America having a credit card. Let's remind people who owns America's debt. Like, I mean, it is upon us to pay it, but there are creditors out there to whom we owe this money. And that happens through the way America, you know, sells bonds. And so just remind people who globally owns America's debt.
Yeah, so the biggest holder of American debt is the Chinese.
Okay, so let's just pause right there. I think we could pause right there, and let me just remind people, I've talked about China's thousand-year America going into ever deeper debt and finding ourselves ultimately beholden to them as our debt holders. You know, it's time for us to wake up to the interconnectedness of all of the conversations that we have here on air. And when we talk about the Game of Thrones going on around the globe, China's got a thousand-year plan. And we as Americans don't. And we're not just living paycheck to paycheck. We're living credit card statement to credit card statement. And the bank behind that is China. And so I just think that it's just time for us as Christians and as American citizens to wake up to some of these conversations. Tommy, can we return to this conversation the next time we talk? And let's talk about the president does have a plan. We have not seen it yet, but we hear that the president does have a plan. And so what I'd like to do the next time we talk is talk about some of the positive ideas that are out there that maybe we could expect to see that we could then all support. Does that sound good?
I can't wait. That's going to be a great conversation, Carmen. Thank you very much for having me. Have a great show.
Absolutely. Tommy Binion from the Daily Signal. You guys can check it out, dailysignal.com. He is at the Heritage Foundation. You can follow him on Twitter at TP Binion. I'll be right back. So we're going to turn our attention to kids here, and we're going to do so with our favorite pediatrician, Dr. Rosemary Stein. We're going to talk about the proliferation in this nation of online preschools and, frankly, what Dr. Rose thinks about that. And there are some parents out there who are offering their children, as young as elementary, what we would call mental health personal days in the workplace. And so we're going to talk about that trend. And then there's an article out there where parents are surveyed about what is the number of kids that makes parents happiest. My opinion on that is just the wrong question. But we're also going to talk about really healthy summer plans you can have for your kids. So that's all up next here on Mornings with Carmen. Okay, we have some really exciting news. We are now live on 107.5 FM in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. So maybe you're listening right now on AM 1270 in Sioux Falls. I'm not telling you to change your station, but if you want to listen to what we're doing static-free on a static-free frequency, you can do so now at 107.5 FM in Sioux Falls. So we want to welcome our 17th Faith Radio signal. If you are just tuned into 107.5 FM in Sioux Falls and you're like, who is this and what is this and what is going on? Well, my name is Carmen LaBerge. You are listening to Mornings with Carmen on the Faith Radio Network. If you're just discovering us, this is what we do every morning from 6 to 8 a.m. Central. And we look forward to helping you reconnect the eternal with the everyday every morning so that you can be equipped to walk your faith out into the world, bringing the mind of Christ to bear on the matters of the day. So if you're in the Sioux Empire and you've got friends in Sioux Falls, pass along the word that we are live and invite them to try out our clear and static-free frequency at 107.5 FM Sioux Falls.
How should Christians prepare for disasters or dislocations? This is Jim Darlow. The Bible tells us to expect trials and tribulations and not to be caught off guard. We are to remain well-versed in Scripture, walking closely with our Lord without fear. Secondly, we should get our financial house in order as stewards of that which belongs to God. Thirdly, we must get our legal affairs in order to help protect ourselves the best we can. And finally, fourthly, we should have personal provisions for our families and our extended church family, as well as for neighbors in our communities, so we can be the hands of Jesus to them in times of calamity. Most of all, we don't walk in fear because we're prepared. So put aside worry, put aside the sin and distractions that crowd into your life, keep God first and foremost, and get well-versed at wellversed.world.
All right, friends, so welcome back. You are listening to Mornings with Carmen. I am joined now by Rosemary Stein. Dr. Rose is available on Facebook at Rosemary Stein MD. She's joining us via Skype. Dr. Rose, welcome back.
Thank you, Ms. Carmen. Nice to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. So I was reading about this proliferation of online preschools, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to ask Dr. Rose about that. Tell us about kids going to school as early as preschool and doing so online, and what you think about that?
Well, the first thing I have to say is that it's not entirely Dr. Rose approved. Kids at the practice tend to laugh at me when I say that line, Dr. Rose approved or Dr. Rose not approved. But online preschool curriculum is not something that I think is a great idea. Now, in my time, we had something called Sesame Street. And Sesame Street was not obviously online. It was TV, which I guess could be equated to that. And some people could argue that some of the things that went, you know, that happened in Sesame Street weren't altogether good. But overall, it was very different from what's going on right now. This is supposed to be sort of an interactive digital experience for children who simply can't get to a preschool for 4-year-olds. And it simulates going to the zoo or exercising or different activities that a 4-year-old can be involved with. And it's just not what a 4-year-old needs to be in front of a digital device for periods at a time. And one of the things that I say is just hand a preschooler a cell phone and try to take that cell phone or the digital device away. There's almost an instant connection between that child and the device. And when you take it away, the child goes into a temper tantrum. So we're almost inducing our own little addiction by having the child learn on the device from such a young age. And I've seen children have a very, very early onset vision deficits because of being on digital devices. And so for all of these reasons and many more, I just don't think it's a good idea to start them on the devices to learn on this early. I would recommend, if we're going to use digital devices, to at least waiting until the child knows how to read, write, and do simple math. That would probably be around 8 or 9 before introducing the digital device.
So, Dr. Rose, reading, writing, and simple math are what those are the subjects that are in view. And so let's encourage parents and others who are listening who are spending time with little kids. Talk with us about how we should be teaching them to read and write and do simple math in ways that are not dependent upon devices that that are screen powered. Because, you know, we're like a flashcard family. I'm not sure that even, you know, people like remember and know what flashcards are, but flashcards are a device that we use in our family. Give us some encouragement on how to de-digitize early childhood education. Grew up maybe, you know, in a digital driven age.
I love flashcards. It's one of the avenues that I seek the most with my parents to teach their children simple math and even the alphabet. So I have probably 2 or 3 dozen sets of flashcards at the practice that I give out. So that is definitely one of the really good avenues to learn the alphabet, to learn your numbers, learn your numerical additions, subtractions, multiplications, and divisions. I like the simple abacus, so the kids understand what is 6. 6 equals this digit. And if you put a 6 together with the digit that's 7, what do you get? And it should be a language to a child. It's like he sees 6 plus he sees 7 and the number just flashes in his head and it's 13. And he understands that. And there's no, you know, breaking it down. And that's what math used to be like. Same thing with reading. The flashcards to start with for the alphabet and writing and big markers or crayons to write the letters with, pointing things out right around the child that start with the different letters, together with a Noah Webster's reading handbook or a McGuffey's reading handbook. Oh my goodness. And it's so much fun and work at the same time. And the children have this indelibly printed into their head when they learn it this way. It's not the same as digital. And I don't know if a lot of people know this, but what you learn on digital devices, 30% of it is lost just because you can't feel it. You can't smell it. You can't turn the page. And so there's a percentage that is lost when you learn things on digital. Same thing happens for kids. And so if we use these avenues, we have to understand that there are distractions or detractions from it.
Okay, so let's talk about this next article. I read this about this mom who is letting her kids take personal days from school, what she's calling mental health days. What do you think about that idea?
Well, at first I'm wondering what she meant, but then I started thinking about it. And I've actually probably told some parents that their child needed a day off, not because they were sick, but because they were going through an anxiety-producing day, or that there was a lot going on at home, or the parents were getting a divorce, or the child was going through a difficult situation. I guess that's a mental health day. It's not a thing to abuse, but it's a thing to have in the back of your mind that is a possibility. And who knows your child better than you, mom and dad, when your child needs a day of break? And isn't that being educated in itself? And once again, it's not teaching them work ethic. It's not teaching them that you can just say, oh, I need this day off. That's not it, because you really go over it with your child. But understanding that education is much more than sitting in a chair and just being placed in front of a tablet or a book. It's really about knowing about life. And if you and your child need to take a day off and just go to the park and really soak in God's nature because something is going on at home, I think you as the parent should be able to go ahead and do that and to experience that with your child.
Yeah, I think the experiencing it with them is really critical and essential. And I have friends who do this, and they actually use the language of Sabbath, and so that their kids know that you can ask for a Sabbath. And when you're doing that, you know that you're asking for a day to simply be with God and in nature and spending quiet time. It's not going to be a day of a break from school so much as it's going to be an intentional day just to allow God to heal the broken parts and tend to who you are and remind you who you are, and a day set apart for Him. So I like the idea. I can certainly imagine how it could be abused, but I think it's good language for parents to have, and good permission for parents to have, recognizing that you are, you are the primary human being responsible for the welfare of your child. And if your child needs a mental health day, then maybe you should take one with them. All right. Dr. Rose and I are going to continue our conversation in just a moment. We're going to talk about an article that asks the question, what number of kids makes parents happiest? That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen. That song reminds us that we have Dr. Rose in the house today. You can find her on Facebook at Rosemary Stein, MD. So, Dr. Rose, what number of kids makes parents happiest? What does the research say? And then is that even the right question to be asking?
Well, I like the way you sequence that. And so I think that before a mom and dad start having children, and life doesn't usually work that way, but if this is a thought out thing, I think that a mom and dad, before they start having children, should really think about what number are we intentional on? And parenting should be intentional. So that there is a place where you should be intentional about what number would we be blessed with? What number would we bless the world with? What number would God want to give us? And I think that's a true conversation that too few people have. I think that we arrive at the number of children that we have just almost by accident many times. So that's really a thoughtfulness in that question. Now, the other thing that I didn't like so much is what would make us happiest? I don't think that we would have children because we want to be happy. I think that we have children because we want to raise good human beings. We want to add good people to the earth. We want to be blessed by our children. We know that children bring joy when they're brought up the right way to glorify God. I think that those are considerations instead of what would make us happy. But I think at the end, when we do glorify Him by having the number of children that we're meant to have, that we are content, that we're blessed, and because that we feel happy. And so I think that the article is obviously written by somebody who doesn't know Jesus and doesn't really think of it from the perspective of a Christian. But I think that we can add our own bent to how many children we are meant and that we would be blessed and bring a blessing to others by having.
So I love that answer, and I think that is just exactly right. I think that this article gives, and this conversation really gives Christians a great opportunity to ask a provocative question in the culture, particularly of their non-Christian friends, and just to say, hey, I read this research and, you know, people are talking about the ideal number of children, what makes parents happiest. And some of them say zero, which clearly means they're not parents. Like, that's a curious answer. One child seems to be statistically what makes parents happiest. But in reality, it makes children the least happy. Apparently here in America, the normative number, and that's an important word in this piece, the normative number is 2. The economist who is interviewed at the lead of the article says the ideal number is 4. Guess how many he has? 4. So I think that, right, when we talk about, you know, how many kids makes us happy, my guess is most of us say the number we have, right? Because we can't imagine not having the ones that we have. And we can't imagine being any happier with, you know, with any more. Like, right, you, whatever a full quiver is for you from God is what makes you joyful and what brings you greatest happiness, because ultimately it's what's God glorifying. And so I think you've given exactly the right answer to the question. I love the notion of, you know, how are the children with whom we are, whom we receive as a sacred trust, how are they going to in turn then be a blessing to the culture of which they are a part? And that's really our contribution in terms of the building of families here on earth. So I just, I love that answer. And I hope that it equips people to really provoke this conversation with other people today.
And I think that one thing to think about is not only how it affects you, but how that number affects them. That was a great point that you made, Miss Carmen, that being an only child, I was an only child until I was 10. Unfortunately for Hannah, my daughter is an only child, and she would have wished so much to have other children. And so for me to have other children. So that is a consideration for people to sit down and think about. Do you want to raise a child that wishes that there were others, or do you want to raise a child that wants everything, you know, that has a lot of brothers and sisters that perhaps wish that they had everything for themselves? How are they going to interact with each other? How is each one of those experiences going to build on forming that person? I know that when I had my brother was given to me, because I thought he was given to me because I was 10, that changed my life. That really consolidated the fact that I wanted to be a pediatrician. Having a brother and a sister really sets you on a different course for the rest of your life. And these are the things that we should be thinking about. What kind of experiences are you giving your children?
Well, and for those of us who've never had our own biological kids, you know, I will say, you know, I feel like my life is tribal with children. If you are a person who only has one child, be sure you're raising that child in the fellowship of believers, where they can have a genuine experience of lots of siblings in the family of faith. If you're a single person, or you are a person maybe who you thought you always wanted kids, but that's just not a blessing that God has given, man, there are lots of kids out there who need Christian parents and who need Christian parenting, even if you don't officially become their parent. I am a hen, man. I parent every kid that I come into any kind of proximity to, because, you know, I want them all shepherded in a positive way toward the kingdom. So, Dr. Rose, you and I are not going to have time today to talk about summer plans. Can we hold that conversation for the next time we talk? Summer is just around the corner, and I would love for you to equip us with some ideas about how to best help our kids reinforce what they have learned, not lose what they learned this school year, but also some ideas about really healthy ways to approach the summer if we do have a kid who, you know what, maybe he's gotten, you know, maybe got a little chubby over this academic year. Like, what are some ways that we can actually encourage health and healthful habits over the summer? Are those two conversations that we could have the next time you come on?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that just like you're saying, it should be something deliberate. It should be something planned out. Of course, there's spontaneity in our vacation time, but there also should be plans. And you should be looking at our children and thinking, what was an instructive but fun thing to do this summer? So I think that thinking about it and bringing that to the table is an excellent idea, Miss Carmen.
Yeah, and I'm using their health as an excuse to firm up some things in my own life. Okay, Dr. Rose, next time we get together, that's what we're going to talk about. Thank you so much. You guys can visit her on Facebook, Rosemary Stein, MD. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. We'll be right back. All right, so we've had a really robust and full hour of conversation, and we've got another one just ahead. Nicole J. Phillips is going to be here to share a kindness story. Justin Gibney from the AND campaign is going to join us for a conversation about the positive and or potentially very negative effects of the legalization of recreational marijuana in urban communities. He's also going to talk with us about an event that just took place called Just Gospel 19, what we can learn from him about that in terms of living a just gospel this year in our own communities. We'll also be joined in the next hour by Peter Kapsner. He and I are going to talk about Justin Bieber. We're also going to talk about, well, probably Lauren Daigle. We're going to talk about Bud Light and some new cans they have out. I know. Peter and I like to do the really hip culture stuff, even though neither one of us are hip. So that's the conversation that is up ahead with Peter. So let me conclude this first hour with this question. As we talk about kids and as we talk about healthcare, that's really consumed our conversation here in the first hour. As we have those conversations, how much responsibility are you taking for your own health today? And when we think about the next generation, what are the kinds of habits that they are seeing in us and experiencing with us that maybe we need to give some consideration to? Are there things today that, in terms of being mature disciples of Jesus Christ, we need to take a look at, we need to reconsider, and we need to apply some energy to? I don't know about you, but there are some pounds to be lost and some things that could be firmed up as I seek to more respectfully reflect who God is into the world and be a winsome witness to the gospel. So there you go. It's a little transformation encouragement for each and every one of us today. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.